Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Supreme Court has struck down a New York law that limits the right to carry concealed handguns in public. It was a 6-3 decision, with the three liberals dissenting. Every Town for Gun Safety tweeted, "As our gun violence crisis gets even worse, SCOTUS has decided to cave to the gun lobby's extreme agenda and make it harder for states and cities to protect public safety." Every Town Chief Litigation Counsel Eric Tirschwell said, "The Supreme Court misapplied fundamental constitutional principles in ruling against New York. Even so, states can still pass and enforce a wide array of laws to keep public spaces safe from gun violence, and we are ready to go to court to defend these laws." 3,720 people in the U.S. have been shot and killed since the mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas, on May 24th, according to Every Town. If the abortion decision does not come down tomorrow, we will discuss the concealed carry ruling. The Supreme Court just came out this week and said they will also issue decisions tomorrow at 7 a.m. Pacific time, and we will bring you the latest. On Tuesday, the court ruled that taxpayer money can now be used to pay for religious education, further weakening the separation of church and state. The National Education Association says the radical ruling further erodes public education. It was another 6-3 decision, with the three liberals dissenting. Joining us to talk about that decision is Mary Kussler, Senior Director of the National Education Association's Center for Advocacy and Political Action. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, can you give us a little background on this case? So it's Carson versus Macon, and taxpayer money is available to families in Maine so they can send their kids to private schools because public schools are not readily available in rural areas. And some of those families wanted to use public money to send their kids to religious schools like Bangor Christian School and Temple Academy, both of which candidly admit they discriminate against homosexuals, individuals who are transgender, and non-Christians, according to the New York Times. And we should put that in quotes. So tell us a little bit about this case and give us a little bit of background first, please.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I think it's really important to understand that we strongly believe that every student across this country should have access to a great public school, no matter where they live. That is the fundamental rootings of our public education system as a corner of our democracy. And so here we have a situation in Maine, which due to the rural nature of so much of that state, that feasibly they cannot, without very long bus rides, get all of the students into public, specifically, it is generally their public high school systems, where there tend to be fewer options statewide. And so Maine, along with a few other rural states, has offered this option. Well, they would provide stipends for parents so that they could go to a closer non-religious private school. And while we still believe fundamentally that it is the public schools that our nation should be investing in and our communities should be investing in, this has been something that has been long held. And so what we really saw this week with the Supreme Court's radical agenda being pushed forth again is another step to undermine our public education system in this country and instead push scarce taxpayer dollars towards religious instruction and discrimination.
How far will this go? If we're just talking about rural Maine in this case, what does the decision mean for other states or other rural areas?
And that is such a great question, because the reality is we might be talking about rural Maine here, but it essentially what we heard in the ruling is that if a state chooses to fund private education in any way, shape, or form, they must fund religious schools. And that is something that A, should not be happening, B, because we want states to be investing in their public education system. But if they are providing any sort of money to essentially private schools in their state, those schools are not supposed to be, in many of the cases, providing any religious instruction with the dollars, should not be discriminating. And so that is why many states have restricted against providing funding to religious schools through their so-called voucher programs.
You know, I want to just correct something I said when I asked you the question to give us some background. The quote that I read there is actually from a Supreme Court brief. The two schools, quote, candidly admit that they discriminate against homosexuals, individuals who are transgender, and non-Christians. This is from the Supreme Court brief. And Justice Elena Kagan said, these schools are overtly discriminatory. They are proudly discriminatory. Other people will not understand why in the world their taxpayer dollars are going to discriminatory schools. And we are learning that students who are trans or openly gay may be suspended or expelled because of their sexuality or gender identity. The school does not hire trans or gay teachers, according to a brief filed by Maine officials.
And I'm so glad you read specifically from Justice Kagan's dissent in this case, because it is sometimes shocking how much we see the radicalization of the court at this time and how much it is right there in black and white in writing. The fact that they are openly discriminating against both students and educators in this case, and that is not what our country is founded on. That is not what we have strove for as a society. And that is why our public education system is so important and why our taxpayer dollars should be funding the education that actually meets all of our students where they are and takes in all of our students, regardless of their disability, regardless of their gender identity, regardless of their English language learner status. And so what we really see is the court undermining that historical and very important role that our public education system plays for our democracy.
What does this mean, given that these schools, according to the briefs, are discriminating against, in this case, LGBTQ students?
I think based on the radical decision here, what we really see is that taxpayer dollars will now be used for discrimination. And that is something that as a parent, I am a mom of a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old. I believe their education is very important, but the idea that the taxpayer dollars that I pay to fund their education could be used to discriminate is against our values as a society.
How do you think organizations that are heavily funded, these organizations that oppose public education, I mean, there's been a war on public education for decades in this country. How will they use this decision to further complete their end goal of ensuring that these kinds of schools get money and public schools do not?
This is the end goal. They are working. This court case was another step closer for them. In their mind, by dismantling our public education system, we will continue to create a society of the haves and the have-nots. We will diminish the ability of that American dream where any student, no matter who you are, no matter where you live, you have a right to that American dream. Now it will become the American dream if you fit a certain mold or if you can pay a certain amount of money yourself. And those public education systems that have been here, that have supported who we have become and who we strive to become as a nation, will no longer be there for the generations to come. This is not a single effort to go after a single state's education system. This is a concerted effort to undermine our public education system as we know it. I think it is fitting. Today is the 50th anniversary of Title IX. And so we have this really important federal piece of legislation that works so hard against discrimination. And yet this exact same week, we see the extremist court agenda pushing for discrimination.
Well, and just to give listeners more information about these schools at issue in this case, Temple Academy in Waterville, Maine says it expects its teachers to, quote, integrate biblical principles with their teaching in every subject and teaches students to, quote, spread the word of Christianity. The other, Bangor Christian School, says it seeks to develop within each student a Christian worldview and Christian philosophy of life.
And the reality is, there is only so much money, so much taxpayer dollars, right? We talk about the fact that way too many of our educators are not even meeting a $40,000 a year minimum income. Educators across the country are having to work two and three jobs just to make ends meet. We know we don't have after-school programs in every community. We know we don't have the enrichment opportunities everywhere. And yet what we see is the dollars that will be the taxpayer dollars that will be funneled to these private discriminating religious institutions are taxpayer dollars that will come right out of the pockets of the children in our public school system.
Well, to your point, and we'd love to have you back on to talk more about this. This is from 2017 from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. It's been a punishing decade for school funding. Public investment in K through 12 schools has declined dramatically in a number of states over the last decade. And then I'm just looking at California, the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. California schools risk colossal loss of dollars. California public school enrollment is down, and so is funding. So we'd love to have you back for a larger conversation about what is happening with public schools and the ongoing attacks on public schools. Thank you so much for joining us, Mary, and we'd love to have you back.
Yeah, I would absolutely love to come back because there is so much at stake here. Thank you so much for the opportunity today, and I look forward to further conversation.
Thank you. Mary Kussler is Senior Director of the National Education Association Center for Advocacy and Political Action. They say that this radical ruling further erodes public education. It was a 6-3 decision with three liberals dissenting. We're also going to do another show about the separation of church and state, because we've got this decision and then past decisions, the court ruling that the Trump administration could allow employers with religious objections to deny contraception coverage to female workers, and that employment discrimination laws do not apply to teachers at religious schools. So there are two major issues to discuss on this ruling: what it means for the future of public education, and then what it means for the future of the separation of church and state in this country. So we will definitely talk about that in the coming weeks. Now we are going to talk about some other major decisions. The court ruled today that suspects cannot sue for a violation of their civil rights when police fail to provide them with Miranda warnings. Justice Elena Kagan, dissenting, says the majority's diminishment of Miranda will ensure that people who are wrongly convicted and spend years in prison will have no remedy for all the harm they suffered. Joining us is Hassan Kanu, a reporter for Reuters, where he writes about justice, race, and equality under the law. Hi, Hassan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, Hassan. When we look at these decisions and look at the effect that this ultra-conservative court is now having on this country, I think it's important that we remember that five of the six conservative justices were appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote. Also, there's a quote going around from Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, which he made in 2016. He said, "One of my proudest moments was when I told Obama, you will not fill the Supreme Court vacancy." So can you just remind us, Hassan, just how conservative this court has become over even the last decade?
Sure. I mean, there's definitely in many respects, this court, it's been known as the Roberts Court for the entirety of the time that John Roberts has been the Chief Justice. But this court is distinct from, folks are familiar with terms like the Rehnquist Court and courts of past eras. And this court is distinct from how those courts have acted. And as you said, it's not just sort of the substance of the decision. You mentioned just now a decision in a case about Miranda rights, right? Those rights are pretty much have been enshrined in the law for decades now. They're sort of some of the most popular just because of television and how crime shows and policing shows tend to work. Some of the most popular sort of rights that a criminal defendant or just any citizen who encounters law enforcement has, right? The right to remain silent and an accompanying set of rights, right? But the court essentially just issued a ruling that essentially overturns that. And that's truly radical. I mean, like you said, there's a number of other decisions that are radical in substance in that respect, meaning the court changed law that's been established precedent for in some cases, four decades plus. But also, it's also about the procedure, the manners in which the court has gone about changing these decisions. And to your point, the Chief Justice himself has in fact joined a dissenting opinion authored by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, where she was criticizing the court for how it's used a shadow docket. That's a term a lot of folks are familiar with by now, and it refers essentially to the court's process for taking emergency cases, right? It's like an alternative queue for the court to hear cases, and they're supposed to be emergency applications, but the court has repeatedly taken up cases in situations where there was no emergency that one could identify, right? And Justice Sotomayor pointed this out in a dissent, as I said, that the conservative Chief Justice John Roberts joined, calling out the other five conservatives on the court for repeatedly taking up questions on the shadow docket, on the emergency application docket, where no true emergency was presented. And it might have been a question of law that was settled just a few years ago. The court has repeatedly, time and time again, in the particular case I'm talking about, it changed a decades-old environmental law rule that gave Native American tribes sort of the ability to participate in environmental analysis for big construction projects. Very, very old precedent, changed under the Trump administration. An emergency application, quote unquote, was filed weeks after the lower court had issued a ruling. There was no sort of emergency construction project identified that needed to go forward, but the court took it up, issued a ruling. And as I said, even the conservative Chief Justice joined this opinion, criticizing the court for not the substance of the ruling, but the form, the way it went about it, and so on two levels, both how the court is changing the law and the manner in which it's actually taking up these cases and breaking its own norms and precedents in order to change the law are pretty radical and conservative leaning.
Hassan, would you mind moving your mic just a little bit? We're getting a lot of the air coming out of your mic and some pops.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. So let's yes, it sounds better. Thank you. Let's talk about the Miranda rights decision, because you wrote about the justices hearing arguments on this case on April 20th. And just a basic Miranda 101, this is basically meaning to safeguard fundamental rights against police coercion, right? I mean, we're all, correct. If anyone gets pulled over or there's any interaction with police, you have rights.
Correct. And Miranda rights exist, obviously, so that, you know, the idea is the cops will inform you of your rights. And, you know, and the idea is basically to establish that we're both playing on a even and fair playing field, right? Right. The police have plenty of authority to investigate you and gather evidence about what you've been doing. And you have certain minimum rights to sort of defend yourself, protect yourself, and so forth.
All right, so let's talk about this particular case. On April 20th, the justices heard arguments in a dispute between Terrence Tayko, a certified nurse assistant who is accused and acquitted of sexual assault, and Carlos Vega, a police officer who allegedly forced him into giving a false confession. So can you give us some background on this?
Sure. So Terrence Tayko is a Cameroonian immigrant. As you said, he was working as a nurse in a hospital. And the way the police became involved is he was accused of sexual assault by a patient who'd actually been sedated. She had to have a procedure. It involved an artery in her groin. And so she had been sedated for this procedure. And in the process of all of this, she became conscious and accused Mr. Tayko of assaulting her as the procedure was being undertaken. And that's when the police were called and came into the hospital.
And the question in this case is whether a plaintiff can file a civil lawsuit if a cop interrogates him without informing him of his rights to remain silent and consult with a lawyer.
Correct. And in fact, there isn't actually any sort of dispute about the fact that the police officer in this case, Mr. Vega, as you said, did actually interrogate Mr. Tayko without giving him the Miranda warnings. Right. He interrogated him in a small room. It was soundproof. Folks outside couldn't see or hear what was going on in the room. According to Mr. Tayko, he was abusive. According to Mr. Tayko, he used racist language. He pressured him using his immigration status, threatened his family with deportation during the course of the questioning. And Mr. Tayko also alleges that he tried to leave the room at a certain point, but the police officer blocked the door. During the course of all this, he was able to obtain what amounted to a confession, essentially. And later on, though, a jury actually heard the case and acquitted Mr. Tayko in a second trial. The first trial ended in a mistrial because prosecutors had some DNA evidence that suggested Mr. Tayko was innocent and hadn't turned that over. So he was sort of exculpated of the crime twice before getting to the Supreme Court. But the court ruled in any.
Oh, I think we lost Hassan. Are you still there?
Are you getting me?
Oh, you just cut out. Can you just repeat what you were saying?
Right. So essentially, there's no dispute really that Mr. Tayko was not Mirandized. He wasn't given the Miranda warning before he was interrogated. There's no dispute that the interrogation as a whole was generally unlawful. On top of that, Mr. Tayko's in his first trial was a mistrial. Prosecutors didn't turn over DNA evidence that suggested Mr. Tayko was innocent. The second trial, he was acquitted by a jury, so he was found innocent by a jury of his peers. So when he sued then to sort of correct this constitutional violation of how the interrogation went, the Supreme Court essentially declined that, said he has no right to sue regardless of what I just laid out, even though he has basically a credible innocence claim.
So this is a really important ruling. Again, it was a 6-3 opinion. All three liberals dissented. Justice Alito said, quote, a violation of Miranda is not itself a violation of the Fifth Amendment. So those who are not Mirandized have no basis to sue for a violation of their rights. Justice Kagan dissented, saying the majority's diminishment of Miranda will ensure that people who are wrongfully convicted and spend years in prison will have no remedy for all the harm they suffered. Ellie Mistal, who is a Nation correspondent, said, folks, this basically overturns the right to remain silent. It means that you cannot sue the state if a cop fails to tell you your rights. Does that sound right to you, Hassan?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I wrote back in April. That was at stake just based on how the conservative justices were approaching the arguments during oral argument. And yes, in practice, there is theoretically some wiggle room to bring a lawsuit. But practically speaking, and even before the court's ruling, because of some conservative majority opinions that the court had issued, it was already so difficult to sue an officer in this case that this opinion now makes it almost every case, it'll be practically impossible to actually sue for that sort of violation.
Wow, this is huge. So what message does this send to police across the country?
I think it essentially says it gives a green light for we are well aware, obviously, of the problem of false confessions, right? And we are all well aware this has been documented for decades in documentaries and legal research. sociological research of why these things happen the way they happen. There's been specialized research done on kids and false confession and how the sort of the pressure that the government officials and government officers and police officers can apply in a private setting like that, and how it tends to produce false confessions often. But what it says is that what it does essentially is it takes the shackles off police to use all those tactics, right? Those tactics, as I said, that we have identified over the years as obviously problematic and clearly problematic and have produced false confessions, wrongful convictions, and evidence would suggest, you know, the executions of potentially innocent people. And what the court's opinion says is essentially that police can sort of feel free to use those tactics and they don't have to worry much about facing any kind of criminal or civil liability. And of course, as we know, they rarely face serious internal discipline either.
And the message this sends to people who are pulled over by police or have interactions with police?
I think the message it sends, honestly, is to sort of acquiesce, to recognize that the minimal rights that I think most Americans rightfully perceive that they have when they're interacting with police are even less than they might have believed them to be 2 weeks ago. Especially for folks of color, for Black folks who, you know, we're all aware now in 2022 of the talk that Black people give to their children. Obviously, you give that talk to your children because it's how you carry yourself in the world as well. And what this ruling suggests is that one should be even more deferential. Of course, we know that doesn't always save your life, right? But what it does suggest is that one should be as deferential as possible and acquiesce to the police, even if you feel like they might be exceeding their authority or don't truly have a reason to be interrogating or questioning or stopping you.
Well, the ACLU tweeted, "Police generally will still have to inform you of your rights to remain silent and have an attorney. But under today's decision, you cannot seek damages if law enforcement violates these Fifth Amendment rights." So this is a major, major decision. And we're talking about it with Hassan Kanu, a reporter with Reuters. He writes about justice, race, and equality under the law. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about a couple other decisions. The Supreme Court rejects its own precedent in a death row decision. The Supreme Court insulates federal agents from accountability, and the Supreme Court prioritizes expedience and wrongful convictions. You can find those pieces at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue discussing coverage of Supreme Court decisions. We are still waiting for the decision that will determine the future of abortion rights in the United States. It might come down tomorrow. We will get decisions at 7 a.m. Pacific time. If Roe comes down tomorrow, we are going to spend the whole hour on that. If it doesn't come down tomorrow, we will talk about the decision that strikes down a New York law that limits the right to carry concealed handguns. And then we'll find out what other cases come down tomorrow. So everything is kind of moving at this point, but we are on it and we will bring you the latest. Talking about other decisions that might not be getting as much attention as the gun decision and definitely the decision on abortion, we're joined by Hassan Kanu, a reporter with Reuters. He writes about justice, race, and equality under the law. There are other major decisions that have come down affecting health insurance payments, disability payments for veterans, and people in prison challenging convictions and sentences in federal court. If you have any questions or comments about the decisions that have come down, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Also tweet us at Your Call Radio and be sure to follow us there for latest news. Again, it's just important to remember that 5 of the 6 conservative justices on the court were appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote. Hassan, let's talk about this really important death penalty case. And thank you for your reporting on this, because the background information is so important. So as you wrote, a Supreme Court decision demonstrates its conservative justices' disregard for well-established judicial norms and long-standing legal rights, even in cases that present literal life or death stakes. The court's decision rejected a petition to reevaluate a death sentence in Andres versus Texas. Again, the three liberal justices dissented. So can you tell us more about Terrence Andres and this case that began back in 2008?
Sure. So this case, like so many of the court's death penalty cases and rulings, involves a horrible crime and horrible facts. This case involves a double murder. Terrence Andres was charged of capital murder for shooting two people during a drug-fueled armed robbery. He tried to steal two people's car while he was on PCP and was arrested and charged with capital murder for that in 2008. And the case really is about sort of the sentencing phase, right? It's about after we get past the guilt phase in the case, how the court deals with the sentence. And obviously there was a death sentence handed down here, and what the Supreme Court was petitioned for was an appeal that was essentially meant to lessen Mr. Andres' death sentence to probably a life in prison sentence based on ineffective counsel, right? The argument basically was that his court-appointed lawyer had done an inefficient job, an adequate job, according to the Constitution. Constitutional right to legal representation hadn't fulfilled that and had basically ignored a lot of mitigating evidence about Mr. Andres' life. He had had a very, very rough, trauma-filled life. He was born to a teenage mom in a very poor neighborhood, struggled with mental health problems, physical, verbal, different kinds of abuse, and many of his caretakers also being on drugs and going back and forth to jail. And a lot of this was essentially not told to the jury and wasn't put in front of the court really to consider during the sentencing. And that's what the appeal was based on.
So none of this information was presented to the jury, which gave him the death penalty, right?
That's right.
So there are many different legal cases here. So can you just give us a little bit of the background, how the court made a decision? And then the makeup of the court changed, and then as a result, the decision changed.
That's right. So the sort of sequence that played out in Mr. Andres' case had actually played out in a different case before involving a different defendant named Brown. And what happened in that case basically is same thing, ineffective assistance of counsel case, inadequate legal representation case. And what happened was the Supreme Court essentially had to decide twice that Texas's highest criminal court had improperly evaluated the case, right? Sent the case back down twice and overturned a Texas criminal court of appeals two times. So the same thing played out in Andres's case. And in fact, actually, before I continue on, in the Brown case that I'm mentioning, on Brown's second appeal, Chief Justice John Roberts joined the liberals in that case and basically said why, you know, in so many words, why he may not agree with the sort of outcome of the case, he had to stick by the court's previous opinion that 2 years earlier, the court had decided that the Texas court misapplied the law, and the Texas court essentially did the same thing when the case got back down to it. So Chief Justice John Roberts said, you know, you have to follow our previous opinion and do what we have ordered you to do as the lower court. In Andres' case, the same thing played out. And just a couple years ago, 2 years ago, the Supreme Court, different makeup, different court back then, sent the case back down like it had done in Brown. When the case, the Texas court did the same thing it did in Brown, right? It applied the Supreme Court's precedent. It sort of reinterpreted the Supreme Court's precedent, right? The Supreme Court had essentially concluded that the mitigating evidence, all the sort of trauma in Mr. Andres and Mr. Brown, in this case, his childhood that I mentioned, was sufficient for sort of a retrial or reconsideration of his sentence. But on remand, again, as I said, the second time when the case came up, different court this time, the court essentially just changed its mind and decided decided not to take up the case. And in fact, what the concept that Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor and even conservative former Solicitor General Ken Starr wrote an op-ed about this, essentially. And the point was basically urging the Supreme Court to overturn the Texas High Court for a second time in order to preserve vertical stare decisis. What that means basically is the constitutional core, constitutional principle that the Supreme Court is the highest court in the land and lower courts have to abide by its holdings, essentially. As I said, the court did that in Brown two times. It did that in Andrus one time after its makeup changed when two more Trump judges were confirmed. It changed its mind and didn't take up the case.
Wow. You know, I was just curious about Terrence Andrus, so I did some reading yesterday. The Marshall Project has a powerful piece called They Went to Prison as Kids, Now They're on Death Row.
That's
Terrence
right.
Andrus suffered through brutal conditions in abusive Texas youth prisons before eventually ending up on death row. He even has his own website. I'm sure someone put this together for him. But there's his art, his writing, information about his background. It's just it's so devastating. I mean, Terrence Andrus is young. So what is the status now of his case as a result of this ruling?
His case essentially means that his death sentence is reinstated. Uh-huh. And to your point, one of the most striking things about Mr. Andrus's case is the time he spent in youth facilities, and including in solitary confinement. Right, that's something that might be shocking. I mean, on international standards, solitary confinement for grown adults is considered a human rights violation. He was under these conditions as a teenager in solitary confinement. With a brain that was still developing and obviously having grown up and without much real adult care, and then had to spend 90-day stretches in solitary confinement as a teenager. And also, if folks want, Mr. Andrus actually wrote a pretty compelling sort of reflection on his case after the court overturned it the first time, where he was grateful that you know, there's so many petitions like this that get filed to the Supreme Court, right? That most of them get nowhere, right? Most of them, it's a prisoner who is representing themselves, goes nowhere. Mr. Andrus has some help from legal folks who are working on his case. Those are the only cases that tend to actually get noticed. He wrote a whole piece reflecting on how meaningful it was to him that the court had taken up his case and had sought to correct the wrong in his case. And what happens now is basically that's been reversed, right? The Supreme Court saved Mr. Andrus's life because it recognized that the Texas Supreme Court had made a mistake just a few years ago. It decided not to do that this time. And from what anyone can tell, because the court did not write an opinion, it was only this dissenting opinion, the reason is basically because there are new justices on the court.
Do we know how Texas officials will proceed from here? How long is Terrence Andrus going to live?
That's very, very difficult to say. These cases, for obvious reasons, folks tend to exhaust therapy if they're able to. Like I said, in a case like Mr. Andrus, where you do have some legal help, folks tend to exhaust and try to appeal as much as they can, especially if they think they have a credible case for either a different sentence or even an innocence claim, right? So that's very hard to say. I do imagine, again, you know the reason why in the Texas court sort of ignored the Supreme Court rulings in two different cases, two different times, is because it's the state of Texas is pretty keen on executing people and carrying out sentences of death sentences, regardless of if there might be questions about those underlying sentences. So I would imagine that there are many actors in that state who would be inclined to move pretty fast to get to an execution as quick as they possibly can. It's hard to say whether or not. Again, a lower court, multiple courts, had agreed with Mr. Andrus's case before it got to the Texas High Court and the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's possible that he could have another appeal that starts off in one of those courts again. But we know sort of how the highest criminal court in Texas is inclined to appeal, and how the highest court in the land is inclined to appeal, including sometimes even if a lower court contradicts it. So,
what does this mean for other people who are behind bars who feel that they had inadequate legal representation?
Right. As you mentioned, it's not just Andrus. The court also issued another case this term called Jones v. Ramirez. It consolidated two cases in that ruling, and essentially said that two men who had been sentenced to death couldn't present new evidence to support their same thing, an effective assistance of counsel claim.
and essentially in this case, what we did, new evidence, quote unquote, is evidence of innocence, right, that had been uncovered previously. And in fact, there are people who are involved in the prosecution of one of these men who have said that they believe that the men were innocent. A lot of the headlines about that Jones Ramirez ruling was that the court has essentially said that innocence is not enough. Right. So to your point, what it means is not only that the avenues to appeal have been limited, but the path the court has been on is both to make it harder to actually appeal a conviction, and then to sort of limit the grounds on which you could win those cases. So what it means is you have less chances to appeal your conviction, again, including if it's a murder sentence, including if it's a death sentence for murder, an incredible innocence claim in that case. It means you have less avenues to actually bring that claim, and it means that when you do, you are more than likely not going to be successful.
Today, we're speaking with Hassan Kanu, a reporter for Reuters, about Supreme Court decisions. And we were just there talking about a decision affecting Terrence Andrus, and you can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. Hassan, another death penalty case, and this is another really important one. Michael Nance is on death row in Georgia, where the only authorized execution method is lethal injection. And this is pretty detailed, just to let you know what I'm about to say. Nance says that a medical condition will cause his veins to blow from a lethal injection, creating a risk of debilitating pain. He has identified a firing squad as an alternative method. The ruling was 5-4. Justin Kagan wrote the majority. Kagan writes that prisoners can challenge their method of execution under Section 1983, even when an alternative method is not authorized under state law. Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote the dissent, saying that inmates should have to bring their claim under federal habeas law rather than Section 1983. And Slate's Mark Joseph Stern wrote, "For those who thought Barrett might be dovish on capital punishment, Nance suggests otherwise." Have you also been following this case?
I haven't been following that particular case just as closely, but to your point and to the point that much of Stern was making, I think that's absolutely correct. I think the entire conservative bloc, I mean, in between just July 2020, we're talking about the few cases I've written about, including this one that I didn't, right? There's many more. In between July 2020 and January 2021, the court's makeup changed, I think, by one justice in that period. But same concept they were discussing since the Trump judges coming on. Between July 2020 and January 21, the court basically cleared the way for a record-setting number of executions in just the last few days of the Trump administration. I think the court is inclined in most of these cases. I mean, I've talked to federal public defenders who, when I sort of drill down, right, and because in many of these opinions, as you say, the defendants, the sort of the facts about their life are sort of scrubbed out of the court's opinion, mm-hmm. if there is an opinion. When I talk to fellow public defenders, I've asked folks and try to drill down, what do you think is really going on in their heads? How do you think they view the law? How do you think they view the policy, social policy, and so forth and so on? And what folks have told me is that I don't think they take these cases seriously, meaning these appeals of prisoner executions. And again, as I pointed out earlier, the appeals that get to the Supreme Court are not frivolous, right? if you make it to that point where you're actually on that docket, let alone something that the court might have left on its docket rather than kicked off, meaning it will reconsider whether it will take this up next term. Those are not frivolous claims, what's clear is what those folks have told me is that they believe that the court is just not interested in hearing those claims and think that in most cases, if you've been convicted, that they're more interested in the finality of that conviction rather than the correctness of it or whether justice was properly done. And if it's a death sentence, they're interested in allowing the state to carry that out. So I think that's fair.
Well, because we talk about these death penalty cases or hear about them on a fairly regular basis, especially around this time of the year. It's important to remember that the United States is a standalone country. In North America, it's the only country that still has the death penalty on the books. Only country, Europe does not have the death penalty on the books. You've got 12 countries performing the death penalty, including Singapore, the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Malaysia, and Taiwan. And I just mentioned that, Hassan, because it's easy to forget that.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the United States is unique among the sort of countries that are usually our comparators globally on this issue. And as I said, as a matter of international law, it's entirely settled, right? I talked about just solitary confinement earlier as a matter of international law, but certainly the executions and the death penalty, to say nothing of the sort of ancient methods that you are barbaric to many sort of social standards that you mentioned. Even if you set those aside and you talk about our quote unquote humane ways of putting people to death. That the United States is fairly singular in that respect.
Right. Let's talk about another story you wrote. The Supreme Court made it nearly impossible for Americans to sue federal law enforcement officers who violate their constitutional rights. The court's ruling grants actual absolute immunity to Customs and Border Protection agents. That is about 20,000 officers who work sometimes involves detaining migrant children and flying drones over protests. Can you tell us more about this case?
Sure. This case, the basic, I mean, the underlying facts sort of speak for themselves. And then, as I said, I'm pointing out that you're saying that the Border Patrol sometimes fly drones over protests to make the point that this covers the whole range of police and law enforcement activity, right? From stopping someone on the street or showing up at your house to ask you questions to something like flying drones over a protest. And what happened in this case essentially was a Customs and Border Protection agent who, and the victim, the plaintiff in this case, was a man who had actually worked as a confidential informant for U.S. Law enforcement at the border. For a couple of different agencies. He ran a bed and breakfast that was directly on the Canadian-U.S. border. So the folks that would stay at his place sometimes were going one way or the other, sometimes legally, sometimes illegally. He had, like I said, had been working as informant for the government for a while, but also had a business. He was obviously making money on these folks, even as he would sometimes turn them into the authorities, right? So there's a question in the case as a basic matter that's sort of been subsumed by the larger issues I'll talk about in a second, but there is that basic matter sort of that the reciprocity between Canada and the U.S. There's a question there: were federal law enforcement allowing this person to break the law? In other words, to further their own personal causes. And this is a man that's just been convicted of smuggling related offenses in Canada, right? And so what happened was he was dealing with an agent who was aware that he had someone from Turkey, I believe it was, staying there and wanted to question the person. This person had actually entered the country illegally, had gone through customs already, so was in the country legally. But the CBP agent entered his property and in the course of all this gets into a confrontation with the man and ends up slamming him on a car, slamming him to the ground. The man's name is Robert Boulay, the inn owner. And so, you know, Robert Boulay files a lawsuit based on this essentially excessive force, right? And you might say also unlawful entry onto his property. And the court basically said that CBP agents are immune from lawsuit. And as you mentioned in the column I wrote, the analysis isn't particularly deep, right? The court didn't cite a whole bunch of legal principles or precedent from 1972 that says this is why it needs to come out this way. The court essentially does a sort of policy analysis, right? And says that in this area, when it comes to the border and CBP, that Congress is better authorized to sort of decide when you can sue. And because the statute doesn't explicitly say you can sue for something like this, even though the Constitution says you have a right to that, the court said you don't actually have a right to sue unless Congress writes another statute. And in fact, Justice Gorsuch points out in a concurrence said basically that, you know, the court has different real messages, quote unquote. The court's real messages are deeper than, you know, what it said in this particular case. And the reason he said that is because he argued that it's going to be hard to find a situation where Congress is not better suited to provide a remedy. And practically what that means is that in almost every case of excessive force or something like that, unlawful arrest, not being Mirandized, obviously that's not a right anymore, but things like that, if you wanted to sue and it was a federal officer, the court would dismiss your case just at the outset, basically.
We have about a minute left. I mentioned that we're still waiting for the decision on abortion. We're still waiting on a major environmental case that's going to determine the future of environmental regulations. What else are you waiting for?
I think, as you mentioned, the gun rights case, I'm still sort of going through the gun rights opinion and reading how that case was written. It'll be very interesting to see how consistent with the leak or different from the leak the final abortion opinion is, whenever that drops. Could be tomorrow. As you said, I think what's important is even as I'm mentioning gun rights and abortion, a previous guest mentioned this as well, but I think what's important, honestly, is how all these opinions will affect the court's legitimacy and credibility in the public eye, right? Donald Trump, who appointed these justices, as I said, the case I discussed just now, the criminal case I discussed just now, illustrates very well how different this court is from just even 2 years ago, right? And in fact, Justice Sotomayor pointed out, we call the court, the restless, newly constituted court, right? Use that phrase in a dissent to call attention to the fact that she thinks there's something to the makeup, right? That there are political the political leanings of the justices might be actually steering their opinions in some cases, as so many folks have accused the court of doing. And I think it's interesting to consider, as most of the public is aware, that the president who nominated these nominees predicted that they would bring back the death penalty, predicted that they would enhance gun rights, predicted that they would enhance legal protections for law enforcement misconduct, predicted they would restrict immigration and abortion, right? Said that outright. I'm going to warn people who would do these things. They've all happened now as of today when the gun rights decision dropped. And obviously the abortion leak suggests that will happen as well. It's pretty hard to argue, and especially, as I said, when in many of these cases, the justice's legal reasoning isn't particularly strong. It's pretty hard to argue against that accusation, even though the justices have now taken it on themselves to sometimes say in public, we're not an ideological cabal just issuing opinions. It's pretty hard to argue against that, given sort of the streak they've been on and procedurally how they've been getting to those decisions.
Hassan Kanu is a reporter for Reuters covering Supreme Court decisions. Hassan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And I really apologize about the audio issues we had on today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.